everybody. This is Robin Ayoub again from the Localization Fireside Chat. Welcome to another recording. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be with my guest of honor. We'll introduce him in a second. Alex Martinez. Alex, we'll let him introduce himself in a second. But I want to thank the audience for joining me on this journey. We're recording this episode. It's episode 181, I think, on our podcast. And today's conversation is going to be a really interesting one. You've heard the phrase of gut feeling. Well, what's becoming increasingly clear is that we may not be that metaphorical of a statement. That's maybe becoming more and more of reality. Our systems today we're going to be talking about biology, the intersection of biology, neurosciences, therapeutic, and a little bit of an innovation in between. This is what Alex is about, and we're going to get to know him in a second. Alex, everybody on this channel, get this question before we get into it. Welcome to the channel first. Welcome to the episode. I really appreciate you being with me.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Robin. I appreciate you inviting me.
And the first question is, what's your story?
What's my story? Well,
How did you get here? How's that? Make it easy.
How did I get here? It's a fairly long one, but I will try to truncate it a little bit. And so what it really comes down to is, you know, I got here because I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I only knew that I wanted to help people out in some capacity. And so that journey took me from, you know, being a teenager, working as an instructional assistant with children with special needs, including nonverbal children with autism, which then, you know, staggered over to my time when I was briefly a pre-med student at the University of Pennsylvania, and then quickly realized that that wasn't for me, but went into sort of a public health and policy side of things. And having initially focused on going into a health policy aspect, I realized that there was a major deficiency in my skill set, because you could come up with great policy decisions and healthcare programs, but lawyers could mess things up. So 2 weeks after I graduated from college, I went to University of Michigan Law School and began my legal career, where originally I set out to be a healthcare attorney. And as has been, you know, the case in my background, I always kind of work in the field while I'm working on the credentialing. And I realized that that was a dysfunctional practice. I was actually perpetuating the dysfunction in the system. And so that turned me on to entrepreneurship as a vehicle to take exciting ideas in the academic lab and getting them actually out to the people that funded them, right? A lot of these things were funded with taxpayer dollars. So getting through the tech transfer program and commercializing these innovations was something that I became very passionate about. I spun out two companies while I was still in law school. And then, you know, following that experience, I ended up at a premier law firm in Silicon Valley, working in the healthcare space, where I quickly realized I was doing the most boring, tedious work for the most interesting companies. And I was like, I want to be in the innovation side. Started my first startup. Shortly after that, it was an MIT spin out. It was a digital health company before that was a massive industry class. So this was like 2008, when you know, hospitals were still were just like going from paper. I mean, it's actually crazy to talk about this, to think about. I started, you know, my path as a business person, my transition is from law to business, when hospitals were still using paper documents.
That's the biggest problem here in Canada right now. Everybody's suffering from that.
Yeah. And so that was part of the, you know, the modernization acts. So in 2008, hospitals were moving on to the electronic health record systems. Mm. And so I had the opportunity to participate that in a major way, actually draft some incentives in the Affordable Care Act. And so from there, I then, you know, I've always had a love of science. So I got a unique role at an up-and-coming biotechnology company called Ionis Pharmaceuticals, where I learned the drug development process. And like, in some ways, I like to think that like that got me into the kitchen of the
Yeah, of course. No, you're inside of it now.
Yeah, exactly. And that was exactly what I want. Basically, what I've been doing the entire time is getting that insider perspective, seeing what the, you know, gaps were that were really impeding innovation. Because like there's so many people out there talking about healthcare reform, the need for innovation, and there are so many systemic issues, including like misalignments, I think, in incentives, that you need to understand in order to actually shepherd something, a great idea, into a solution that's actually benefiting people at large. So, you know, learning pharma, worked on drugs that got approved, including, you know, one that was a transformative drug for a pediatric rare disease. So it literally had a Lazarus effect on children with spinal muscular atrophy. So normally they were not alive by age 2 years. And if children were given this drug early on, they developed entirely normally and are leading normal lives. So that was a privilege to work in that program. But at the same time, I recognize that, you know, both that company as well as the pharmaceutical industry, they were really just focused on these rare genetic disorders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sadly, again, being in the kitchen, hearing how the soup is made, you learn things like, well, these patients are going to die anyway. So the drug, you know, even if it has severe side effects, can still be approved. And for these rare diseases.
Wow. That's quite the statement. Yeah. I never heard of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's true, right? Like it's true, and it's true categorically because risk benefit changes. It's the same thing. Chemotherapy literally kills you, and hopefully it kills the cancer a little bit faster than it kills your healthy cells, right? Same thing with other oncology treatments. They have, you know, profoundly significant, often fatal side effects, but it's, you know, it's up to the patient to have informed consent and then determine what they want to do, you know, in their healthcare journey. And so with rare diseases, it's similar. You know, these are fatal. So it's like, choose your fate. Do you want a chance, or do you, you know, want to just have a natural history course? And so learning that is, you know, there, it creates certain tensions. And I think the biggest one was that disproportionately all this innovation is going towards teeny tiny, like one in a million patients. Meanwhile, the population is just getting sicker in mass, and our health span is declining. In fact, when we look at it, we see that people, yeah, they're actually our mortality is going down now, but people, while they're living somewhat longer, they're living a lot longer sick, mm-hmm. with chronic conditions. And so me and my co-founder came up with a thesis, and we said, look, we want to do something different. We want to develop drugs for ourselves and our families, right? For the ones that most people are going to succumb to, which are not genetic disorders. They're these chronic conditions with multiple factors. And so we looked at it from an evolutionary perspective. We said there's also a certain amount of hubris in the pharmaceutical industry.
We're getting to know a little bit about pharmaceutical industry soup kitchen now.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. I haven't left them a Yelp review, but it would be low. And so really the thesis was that nature knows best, that there's an intelligence in natural systems, and the solutions to these big pressing problems would actually be found in our own biology. And by that, I mean, when we look at all these chronic conditions, they all have different names. Mm-hmm. But when we get to root causes, we see that there's a common driver, and that's dysregulation of the immune system and a dysregulation of the gut microbiome. And so then with that sort of common causal thread, we used evolutionary biology as a lens, and we found some compounds in human milk, of all places. And these are oligosaccharides, which is a long-winded way of saying sugars. But these sugars can't be digested by the human body for energy. They don't provide any calories to the baby. So why is nature putting these at such a significant concentration with a diversity? There's over 200 distinct structures of these sugars. And when we looked at it, we realized we're like, this is a nature's pharmacy for human beings at their most vulnerable. And what these do is they train and foundationally set the gut microbiome, as well as program the baby's immune system and brain. So they're the perfect molecules for these chronic diseases that, you know, we now, looking at them holistically, can categorize as gut immune brain axis disorders. And our simple question that we're asking, these are already proven to work in babies, do they still work in adults? And so that's why I'm here. I've been working on this for 8 years. I left a very lucrative career going from insider to, I'd say, outsider, and trying to do things differently because there's amazing evidence that, you know, from the initial pitch, right, is, and we'll kind of get into that, is that the gut really, gut health is human health.
So you're right. You went from an insider to an outsider. In your observation, why do you think traditional pharma may not be optimized for root cause interventions? And it seems to be only dealing with after the fact and after the diseases versus at the front end of the healthy systems before they get sick later.
It's a great question. And one of those is, you know, I know there certainly are financial incentives, right? You could always say, well, you know,
stock market.
Yeah, exactly. When you have quarterly earnings, you say, hey, you know, a cure is one time, you know, treating symptoms is perpetual. But actually, I like to go further back because it's a little bit more complex than that. I think that's one contributing factor. But before, you know, the early, like before about 2014, the top 75% of prescription drugs were actually naturally derived or, you know, sort of very similar. Really, it truly inspired by nature. So either plant derived compounds or a compound in the human body. And in 2014, there was a Supreme Court case, this myriad, where, you know, what had also happened at this time? It was the Human Genome Project, right? So all of a sudden, we're unlocking all of these.
That's where we mapped the genome, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we mapped it in, around, the late 20, going up to like 2010. And so what happens is you see all these associations between these genetic and companies started patenting genes. And Myriad was the one that patented a diagnostic test for the breast cancer, the BRCA gene. And that was pretty concerning, right? If you can patent a gene, then you could be the only one developing a treatment for it or the only one testing for it. And so in the US, the government was putting together a legislative response to it. They were going to try to make a law because it seemed to be counter to public policy. But lucky for them, because it was not well worded and actually would have stifled innovation, the Supreme Court had a ruling that you couldn't patent a naturally isolated compound or target. And so that prohibition on gene patenting changed the incentives. And all of a sudden, companies said, wow, that also means we can't get what's called a composition of matter patent on a naturally isolated compound. So lo and behold, they said, we're going to make the most complex synthetic chemistry drugs targeting these new genetic associations. And because of, I'd say, bolus of science following the Human Genome Project, which we actually now know is genes are less deterministic than we thought, because epigenetics was not known at that time. So we didn't know that the environment can change gene expression. And what also changes gene expression is the microbiome and the immune system, right? The biological feedback loop of the human ecology. And so you had pharma pivoting to really synthetic approaches. They wanted to target, you know, mRNAs. They wanted, you know, specific targets on all these associations. And so really that was the driving factor. And then by focusing on rare diseases, so these are monogenic, where somebody has horrific outcome from a single mutation. So that's the strongest genetic association. Those are true causal genetic associations. So then they're using these crazy synthetic chemistries, which have crazy side effects, right?
True.
Or gene therapies, right? Which, you know, the early gene therapies, you know, killed someone and they do have, you know, other serious side effects. So all of a sudden this opportunity goes where you can go into these patients where you take out that mutation, you can produce a benefit, or which can be then viewed appropriately in the context of the risk of the chemistry that got you there, the biochemistry that got you there. And because these patients are a very tiny part of an insurer's beneficiary pool, you can charge like $500,000 plus per year per patient. And so then that set the incentives, and then Wall Street rewarded rare disease companies. And lo and behold, you have this system where there's no innovation for, you know, the major chronic disorders, and certainly no new truly safe therapeutics. And that was one of the aspects that we recognize, is that safety has become the ultimate ethical arbitrage opportunity in pharmaceutical development.
So for the audience who's listening to this right now, and they're thinking, okay, so it doesn't matter what drug I take, the list of side effect for each drug is like longer, much longer than the benefits stated. And so how do you balance side effect with benefits, I guess, A? And B, a lot of times we see side effect causing harm, like physical harm. Are we educated enough on side effect, or are we, as a public, from what you're doing, are you considering side effects as well from what you're trying to create?
Yeah, and that was really the first principle, is going back. First, do no harm. And when we looked at these compounds, the first thing we looked at was toxicity. And, you know, amazingly, you know, these compounds are five times less toxic than baking soda. You know, they're less toxic than sugar, than actual table sugar. And so the other aspect that gives us comfort is these are taken for long durations in very vulnerable, tiny people. And then we also had child and adult studies with them, going to doses that are, you know, much higher than the ones that we think will be therapeutic. And there really are no side effects. And the beauty of something that works through the microbiome, at most you would have a tolerability issue, which we can mitigate. You just have to go low and slow, right? You just have to slow it down, because one of the things that we've seen is that the patients that have some bloating, have some gas when they first start taking these, they're the ones that are actually going to benefit the most, because it means their microbiome is truly turning over in a very profound way. So we've developed titration protocols for it. And the other aspect that's really, I think, important when you're, you know, developing something that you want to help people is reversibility.
What do you mean by reversibility, Alex?
So you want to be able to, if somebody really truly is, you know, having some reaction or their health deteriorates, you want to be able to withdraw the drug.
It's like almost like an antidote.
Yeah, you want to be able to reverse its effect. And, you know, I worked on some programs where, you know, the drug would stay in your body for like 3 months. So if you're having a bad reaction to that, like, you actually had to develop a true antidote. With oligosaccharides, you just stop taking them. It's like a 24-hour thing. And so we've never seen any side effect over a mild one, and it's all related to the drug actually working. So it's more of tolerability, no safety. And then another aspect, because I think it's important for me to kind of put my money where my mouth is. One of the philosophies that we came up with, it was almost a thought experiment. We said, well, what would happen if every pharma CEO had to take their drug first? Right? Wow, we'd probably have a lot of really safe, good drugs, right? All of a sudden, we would like really level up. And so
did I hear, is that true though? You're probably more familiar with this than I am. During COVID, I guess, there was some CEO who refused to take their own, I can't remember, I saw stories, maybe they're made up, I have no clue. There's some CEO that refused to take the vaccine because I don't know what it was. But it was the CEO of the company that made the vaccine. And you're right, you bring a very good topic. If the executives of a pharma company was forced to take medication that they are making, maybe some question marks there.
Yeah, because normally you're supposed to do a healthy, normal volunteer study first, right? You're testing safety before you test efficacy, so you should just sign up. And so I actually have been taking my drug, my lead compound, consistently for 5 years.
And when you talk about the compound, just for the individual users that are listening to us right now, Alex is talking about the compound found, again, let me repeat this, in human milk biology. They were able to separate these compounds, and mentioned earlier in the conversation, to about 200 compounds.
Yeah.
Thereabout. And they found out that these compounds are useful to be used in a human body therapeutic down the road when you're an adult. And the idea here is, what made you healthy when you're young is to revisit that and see if that, whatever made you healthy when you were young, when you were a baby, would that help you as you age? And as you age, correct me if I'm wrong, some of the diseases, the degenerative diseases that you're trying to target is like Alzheimer's and arthritis and a bunch of other things. Am I correct by saying that, or am I missing something there?
You are. The lead program is actually Parkinson's disease.
Parkinson. Okay.
Yeah. And I think this is kind of, it's an important, you know, concept, because when people traditionally think of Parkinson's disease, they think, oh, this is a brain disease, right? And that's where billions of dollars have gone, is to treat what's going on in the brain. But over the past year and a half, there have been studies, you know, equaling about 34,000 patients and with Parkinson's disease, and then looking at their sort of prior patient histories, it was seen that what's the biggest risk factor of developing Parkinson's? Having a history of irritable bowel syndrome with constipation or chronic constipation. And the risk of developing Parkinson's, if you had that, was like 400% higher than, you know, someone without it.
Can you test for that?
Absolutely, because you have patients that are chronically constipated. That's
No, I mean for the existence of the biology that drives that, I guess.
So you can, but what's pretty interesting is it creates the opportunity here by looking at the gut as upstream of these disorders, right? In some ways, like I like to maybe I'll orient the listeners. If we stretch out the entire system, our gut, starting at our mouth, is upstream of the brain.
Yes, that's right.
It's also where we're taking in.
And people who drink alcohol probably can attest to that.
Yes, right. That's funny. And, you know, it's the same with everything, right? In our gut, we have a border crossing between truly the outside environment. When you eat, you're taking something that's completely external and you're bringing it into the body. And there's literally a single line of cells in your gut, and it's opening. So the inside is open to the outside. And when your gut's not healthy, like when you're in a chronically constipated state, you have a bunch of leakiness and you have pathogens, you have toxins that can enter the bloodstream. And our gut has a direct line to our brain, and it's through the vagus nerve. And so the biology is testable, but what's really interesting is that you have constipation as a functional risk factor. And that's important, because if you just address that, you've made a meaningful difference in somebody's subjective daily experience, as well as reduce this downstream risk of something that's really...
Is this the system that you're describing about, I guess it was called... I read something somewhere when I was preparing for this interview, for this podcast. Is this what you would call a microbiome signaling pathways? Is that it, or did I get it wrong again?
Yeah, I think it is. But one of the things that I, you know, the same concept of upstream, I think, is really important, because we're targeting upstream of this, the entire human system, effectively.
Correct.
Oligosaccharides are different. These are not living. These are not probiotics, right? Probiotics are bacteria as drug, living organisms as a drug or therapy. Oligosaccharides are prebiotic. And what's special about the human identical oligosaccharides is that they not only change the bugs, the microbes that are in the gut, to the healthy, diverse ones, they also feed them. So they produce what are called postbiotics, which are used by different cells in the body as energy sources and as resources for those cells to be healthy. And these are not prebiotics like plant ones, because that's about the limitation of what a plant-based one. These compounds also directly interface with immune cells and neuron cells, and some of them enter the bloodstream. So they have direct activities. And that's kind of where they can balance out immune responses. So we tolerate our own cells. They actually train the immune system to tolerate our own cells. This is the root cause of autoimmunity and allergies.
Yeah.
And so prebiotics represent an upstream opportunity to effectively hit and restore to homeostasis, restore to balance the entire microbiome ecology.
And that's the modulation of the immune system, I'm assuming.
It's a modulation of the immune system, the microbes themselves, the postbiotics, what the microbes are producing, and then directly supporting certain somatic cells as well.
Now, there is an idea out there, Alex, I'd like to get your opinion on, that the bacteria may influence intelligence in general. And is there evidence that supports this actual theory or no?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we always looked at is the epidemiology. So we were actually looking at groups of patients, and these are, you know, these are mothers and babies. Mm-hmm. And different moms have different levels of specific sugars in their milk. And ones that had higher levels of specific sugars, including some of the ones that we're developing, had better executive function. And that's in humans. And then experiments were done in animals, right? So this is called a reverse translational, where you're saying, here's a finding, an association we see in people. Wow, that's pretty interesting. And lo and behold, we also share some of these sugars. Mice have them in their milk as well. And so we're able to test that, and you're able to then remove one of these from mm-hmm. the animal's milk. And lo and behold, they have literally different intelligence, different problem solving. And so that's all a function of, you know, the microbiome system. And one of the other things that I think is kind of an interesting anecdote is the microbiome really does have influence. For example, sugar cravings, where might those come from? Are those really you?
From what I'm hearing from you, there's 200 compounds made out of sugar was fed to you when you were, little.
That's funny. Yeah. So those are the good kinds of sugars, but
the good kinds of sugars.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they bad behave after.
Yeah. The glucose, the candy sugar, who's craving that? Is it actually you, or is mm-hmm. it something in your gut? And what likes that? It's candida, it's yeast. Right.
So in your opinion, I guess every individual is different. Every case is different. So those microbiome and the microbiome diversity in an infancy stage of an individual, a baby, et cetera, I'm assuming each individual has a different level of these microbiomes. Like a mother would have, I don't know, a set of microbiome. Another person will have another set of microbiome, or are they identical? It doesn't matter which individual we're talking about. And does that diversity in the microbiome correlate to a long-term cognitive resilience? Yes or no, or perhaps other issues down the road may form.
Yeah, it's
sorry for the loaded question. So
no. It's an absolutely great question, and so, you know, please remind me if I'm missing a part. It's not a not intentional, but I would generally say this: the microbiome is going to be localized, right? They're probably, this is why there's not one size fit all. Like, we have to think about the microbiome almost as an environmental interface, like it's an acquired immune system, right? And a microbiome is literally our first line of defense. And so those are going to be different. Right. It's why you can look at like hunter-gatherer cultures and stuff like that. It's completely different. They have one that's optimized to their local environment, and it doesn't have the disruption we have of hygiene, right? I mean, we're having to rethink hygiene. It's called the hygiene hypothesis, and it's what has likely led to the epidemic of autoimmune diseases. And so diversity is really important, but what we're finding out is what's even more important is what the microbes are actually doing. And that's going to be based on what they're using as a resource. It's prebiotics. It's what the prebiotic constituents are enabling those microbes to mm-hmm. perform at an optimal way to nurture the human organism. But I think the other thing that's really important is when we look at this is our opportunity to really think ecologically, and are there keystone species in the microbiome? The answer is absolutely yes. And those keystone species are absolutely critical. And the sort of the most understood and important ones are Bifidobacterium, which are commensals that they're basically symbiotes who have co-evolved with human beings. And when we look at their trajectory, they're like the vast majority in early life, and they diminish over time. And when we actually look at them prematurely diminishing, mm-hmm. we see things like frailty, we see a reduction in health span, and we see an increase in chronic disorders across the board.
Yeah. No, I've seen it actually in my own family. My younger brother with five kids, where for some reason he was not able to eat or drink or however you qualify that mom's milk, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. So, and mom had to substitute. I was a young kid. I was 8 years old and I barely can remember, but my mother has to get like regular milk and feed the baby regular milk, not her own milk. Now, he grown up to be a healthy man. Now, if he's listening to this podcast, he's going to be cursing me for bringing that up. But that's okay. I don't know if there are those cases out there where that's valid. I mean, I'm sure there are many cases out there where a human being are born and they're not able to or don't have access to the mother's nutrition. How's that affecting people down the road, do you think? Has that been looked at?
Yes, it has. It's a challenging one. I mean, there was a campaign, Breast is Best, but that also creates its own issues, right? Because there are situations where a mom is just unable to. A lot of mothers get things like mastitis or they're passing food allergens, literally from my son's birth experience, right? That's the same thing, right? We were adamant about breastfeeding and the baby was getting, my son was completely rashed out all over his body because my wife had food allergens that were her allergies and her antibodies were actually passing through to the milk. And once we got that, once we understood that, then she had mastitis. So it was just a big challenge. You know, what we, then had to do is I actually had to, unfortunately, the U.S. formula is not good. It's not optimal. It's not optimal. The European ones are really the best, especially when you're dealing with allergens. And so, luckily I was actually able to mix these compounds in based on scientific evidence that showed that it could regulate the immune system similarly to a breast milk. And so I think that, was your brother a cesarean section or a vaginal?
No, natural.
Okay. Natural. So that I think that would be, that would orient him towards that because that is the initial inoculation of the mother's microbiome, which then is there and would persist. And especially with the introduction of solid food and plant oligosaccharides would be able to flourish. So that's a more resilient one. It actually, I think what's equally as important is it's very important to pay attention to breast milk if you're a cesarean section, a C-section born because you missed that initial inoculation. And luckily there are some microbes present in the breast milk. And also, skin to skin contact is also really important for trying to reseed what wasn't given in that initial birth canal inoculation.
So let's move a little bit to the degenerative ones. And where are you right now in the development cycle for drugs for those Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, IBD, and autism?
Yeah.
Under one umbrella, I guess, right? Is that what you call a GBA disorder? Did I get
yes,
that right?
Yes, yeah. And so we're getting ready to initiate phase two programs. So those are kind of mid-stage clinical studies in Parkinson's disease. And with that, we are also measuring sort of those irritable bowel syndrome endpoints, which I think is really important because then it really keeps us on a critical path towards a more rapid approval. So this is like where the strategy comes into place. You can get an approval just on the basis of the GI improvements, right? So we can get this out to patients and then you can have, a longer term study going on for like the motor, non-motor and cognitive improvements. So it is a rapid path because we don't really want to be in one of these situations where you say, hey, here's some hope, but not for you. Right.
That's right. That's right.
Behind you. And that's been one of our, one of our big strategic pillars. And then on that basis, we'll be expanding. There's also an IBD study that's ongoing in pediatric and young adult patients. And, autism is one that I think there's a profound interest in. And, the way we'll also go into that is, and this will likely be staggered to the adult study. We still need to meet with the regulators because, they always like to see adult data before you go into kids, but luckily we have the pediatric IBD study. So I think that can accelerate our move into autism. And what's, fascinating about autism, and it's really near and dear to my heart, having, served those families and worked directly with kids that could benefit from this, is the most common comorbidity is GI issues. About 80% of the children are constipated. And where these compounds would be, that alone is a profound improvement and will absolutely improve behavior as well, especially in children that have challenges communicating. The other aspect I think that's interesting about this is, children with autism have, palatability issues, right? As a diet, and there's also aspiration. So they have trouble chewing. They also often kind of choke on their food. And so these compounds actually taste good, and they readily mix into water. And because it's not a living organism, aspiration risk goes down, right? If you aspirate a bacteria, you're in trouble, right? It leads to pneumonia. But for these compounds, you don't have it. And it also can just, again, mix into the most easily, you know, a smoothie or something like that. So I would say that, you know, we are looking to also engage our regulators to talk to them about this, because one of the fascinating things is that these compounds are generally recognized as safe to be included in infant formula today. Again,
it shouldn't be a stretch basically to get an approval, is that what you're saying? You already approved it.
Yeah, so there's an opportunity to advocate for pragmatism in the regulatory paradigm. Mm-hmm. Discuss a standard that will be sufficient for physicians and patients to make, again, educated decisions and give good informed consent. But then we also need some pragmatism in terms of, you know, the moment we're able to show benefit with effectively no risk, which almost no drug has ever shown, how can we collaborate to advance these much more rapidly? And so, yeah, so that's really kind of the roadmap.
What is the regulatory path for you in the US? How do you take a drug through the regulatory process?
Yeah, so typically there's three phases. You have what's called an IND, an investigational new drug meeting. You present preclinical data. You say, this is the disorder I'm going to, you know, I would like to test it in. Then they look at it. They say, okay, you know, first we want you to do safety studies. It's called a phase 1 study. It's usually in a healthy, normal volunteer. You're establishing basically the highest tolerated dose. So those are some brave people, right? Because, you know, college students usually, right, who are being paid to go into these studies, and they're basically dosed with this drug until they have side effects and tolerability issues and withdraw.
So you're testing the upper limit and the lower limit, or just the upper limit?
The upper limit. You're testing probably the lower limit for target engagement, and then the upper limit for target engagement and toxicity, effectively. And then you'll have identified your dose to go into a phase 2 study. And this is, I think, the most important study, is the proof of concept study, where you actually go into patients. And usually you may try out one dose, or you may try out a couple different doses. And then if you're positive there, you have an end of phase 2 meeting with FDA, and you say, here, look at my risk benefit profile, right, from my proof of concept study. And then you propose what's called a pivotal program, which are the phase 3 studies. It may be a single study, it may be multiple studies. And those are the ones that you get approved on. If they're positive and there is, you know, benefit above the risk, and then you would submit that for approval. And one of the things that we've been able to do, which actually cuts 5 to 7 years off of traditional drug development, because from preclinical to, you know, phase.
Just how long it take to get a drug from idea to commercial, 7 to 8 years? Is that what you're thinking?
No, like it's 5 to 7 years to just get into clinic from idea to developing the drug, to doing the tox, to like getting into healthy, normal volunteers and saying, hey, it's safe enough to go on and try to treat patients. You know, it can be, you know, 10 plus years to.
So how far are you from commercialization, Alex?
So we're in that middle stage. And I think that's like...
So a few years to go then.
Yeah, so a few years. So what we've been able to do is we've been able to leapfrog into phase 2 studies, and it's leveraging the safety data that's available for these compounds. So that's what gives us really strong encouragement that we can deliver on this foundational premise, because we're seeing regulators actually agree with us that we can go directly into these proof of concept studies.
So what are we considering here in terms of what is the drugs, I guess, the ultimate goal here? Is it a preventative medicine, a disease modifying therapy, or both?
Yeah. It's both, short answer. But the paradigm that I would like to really emphasize is based on the basically expected safety, and this is based on a wealth of clinical data in infants, children, and adults. We think that this, and the fact that we're going after sort of the GI aspects, which, and then we can also measure, you know, the microbiome, the full omics of the microbiome, along with that, people with Parkinson's disease, they present with constipation and REM sleep disturbances. Those are before you get like motor, major cognitive symptomology. Mm-hmm. And so the paradigm here is to move as close to a true prophylaxis, true prevention, by addressing it at that stage. And the reason why that's viable is because of the safety and tolerability as well as reversibility of these compounds. So it's a new paradigm. And our goal is for, you know, and what we hope to show is that we're able to stop progression.
Yes.
Or even reverse it. And that's a true disease modifying agent.
Are you targeting a specific age group or all age groups?
So in Parkinson's disease, it's typically people over 60 that have those two components, the sleep disturbance as well as the constipation. That would be, I think, your triad of red flags. And our goal is to, we're testing this in mild and moderate patients, which is really important because we want to get people as early as possible. And you know, I'm sure we'd also test this in some of the younger patients that get Parkinson's, even though those are mainly like genetically caused.
Now, the long-term implications, is there any long-term implication?
I mean, the long-term implication is that...
I'm hoping that the medication will prolong life, better life for the patient, et cetera. But is there any further implications than that?
Yeah, I actually think that this can improve health span because the important thing to think about is that these compounds are anabolic, right? They like... In the context of the infants, they promote growth. They promote neuroplasticity. Like we see, they promote neuroplasticity. They upregulate what we would call longevity pathways in the body. And so where I'm hopeful is that what we'll see is once we see stabilization of the disease state, then we see improvements. And so for example, you know, the lead compound we have, which is 2-FL. And the other thing I didn't mention is these are produced with synthetic biology. We're not taking these away from babies. Donor milk is for babies. It's not for developing pharmaceutical products, but these are natural identical. And because of how they're produced, we also will be able to not have financial toxicity. We won't be able to have to charge. And it's not our ethos to charge exorbitant amounts. We want broad access of these compounds. But our lead compound, for example, while it has all these profoundly beneficial things that we think can impact Parkinson's, in older animal models, it's been shown to promote muscle development equivalent to anabolic steroids. So what an amazing paradigm that you can have is you could have people, you know, on, you know, longer term, you know, and actually one of the things that really helps Parkinson's is exercise, is a routine exercise program. So if we're able to ameliorate the symptoms that frustrate that, and these people are then able to make other lifestyle changes, this compound is actually may help them, it may be synergistic with that. And I think that's kind of the exciting thing about it.
Now, are you thinking like down the road from a long-term perspective that microbiome profiling becomes like some standard pediatric screening?
I think it's a great concept. I absolutely do think there needs to be a paradigm there where we can look at the baby's microbiome. What we'll need to also do in that context is that's an intervention opportunity. So for example, I don't know the familiarity, but many people have heard about the fecal microbiota transplants, which is literally taking someone else's microbiome and transplanting it. We love those because each one of those is a proof of concept that that disorder can be intervened with at the microbiome level. And so I think going off of your concept, we probably need to test for babies that have a low diversity, basically that are mismatched to their moms, right? So that they didn't get that inoculation. And then I think there's a window where we can inoculate them. It's effectively doing an FMT from their mother to that baby along with either her breast milk or donor milk or an enriched, you know, formula that contains these compounds to help to promote the colonization of those. I think that would be the paradigm we would go through. And I think we could actually change, you know, the health trajectory in a single generation.
Now, one of the interview I did on this podcast, it was with a company called Canary Speech. And I'm happy to do the introduction with the CEO of the company, if that helps, where now they are using artificial intelligence and speech recognition to detect those diseases that you just mentioned, you know, autism, Parkinson's, Alzheimer, etc., in any language. And, you know, we're a language podcast here. And so we, you know, we'll throw that in there, and I throw that in there in every podcast, is that different demographics, different cultures deal with these types of diseases a little differently, or Sometimes you can misdiagnose them because somebody did not really was able to elaborate or explain directly what was going on. But these guys have created a technology where you actually, it listens to the conversation between patient and doctor. It doesn't matter what language they're speaking, and they're able to give a clear diagnostics on where is the disease states is at right now. So, you know, if that's helpful from a conversation perspective, we'd be happy to facilitate.
I'd welcome that, Rob. And I think that's one of the things that we think about. I don't consider Intrinsic Medicine to be a pharmaceutical company. It's a patient solutions company. And that's precisely the type of organization, you know, we'd love to collaborate with.
Yeah, I'll introduce you. No problem. I'll take a note of that and I'll introduce you. One of the, you know, since I started talking to you, I had this question in my mind, and I've held off on asking, but I have to ask. Most of these diseases at the at that age group, like over 60, etc., and deals with the drugs that is going to be used with those types of diseases deals about, you know, improving life, extending life, making it a little bit easier for the family and the individual involved in the disease. There is a program in Canada, I'm not sure in the US if you guys have it, it's called MAID, Medically Assisted Death. How do you balance these two? Is it becomes an ethical thing, or is it becomes a policy thing? I'm just confused, I guess, and people are listening to this probably as confused as I am. Yeah. Which one does it come first, the medication, or do we encourage people to, yeah, you're done?
Well, I also am confused. I did a lot of bioethics stuff in undergrad. And when I heard about the MAID, it's very concerning, right? Especially when you're in a single payer dynamic. In the US, it's not widespread. And I think it's almost the bright side of a capitalist system, right? A for-profit healthcare system, right? Because we would love for people. It's like, who are the biggest money makers? Is the cancer treatments that prolong life like 6 months, right?
Okay.
So yeah, I think it's a unique dynamic. I mean, like right over a border, we're seeing essentially a single payer, and you're saying like, oh, is it futile? You're looking at the pharmacoeconomics of human life and productivity. And, you know, I think our goal would be, again, I think with a prophylactic paradigm, with something that's well tolerated and something that most importantly is actually priced. So it's injecting value back into the healthcare system, right? I have to think about this as a planetary product, right? These compounds are relevant to every single one of us, right? And so that means I have 7+ billion people that can benefit. And how do I produce this at scale where there really is no national or regional discrepancy in access? And so honestly, the main thing scares me is alarming, because I think that these people are vulnerable. And my biggest thing is informed consent, health literacy, and coercion. And if somebody has a serious disease, they're also going to be really depressed, right?
Yeah, like we've heard some cases. I don't know. I mean, I'm just repeating what I hear. I can't confirm, but I've heard some cases where, you know, depression is a cause of that. People would just, because they're depressed and psychologically probably under pressure, they did some of that stuff. And what was it? Since the program was launched in Canada, I heard a number that was scary, 76,000.
Yeah. I heard a large one. Yeah. And I heard the depression one as well, which is extremely concerning, because that's opening up a Pandora's box. Because, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are in the US, but like a third of, you know, young people are on SSRIs, right? And have some sort of like significant mental health disorder. And then if you look at the ones that are considered treatment resistant, then all of a sudden someone would say, oh, I've been treatment resistant depressed for this year. And all of a sudden, or, you know, young people are entering the suicide pods.
Well, I want to thank you so much for the conversation. You know, I thought we're going to be talking like for 45 minutes. I can go for another hour. This is such a fascinating topic. And although I'm not a doctor, I play one on TV, by the way. No, I'm just kidding. you know, I was talking earlier about another podcast where we're doing cybersecurity and cognitive cybersecurity. And now we're talking about drug development. It's such a fascinating journey, this podcasting thing. It is, you know, you can talk about various topics. You do the research. I do the research on every topic, and I'll make sure that I understand exactly what we're going to be talking about before the interview. No interview goes unnoticed to me, for my personal preparation for this. And I'm sure for the guests as well, they do prepare as well. So I want to thank you, Alex, for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Robin, it's been a pleasure. And to the audience, thank you as well.
So for the audience, thank you so much for joining me on this journey for this particular episode on 181. Thanks for watching us on YouTube, if you're coming on YouTube. And thanks for listening in on our podcast channels. I really appreciate your support. We're approaching close to 2 million views per week now on the podcasting channels. We're almost 1,000 downloads per day. So thanks for all your support. I really appreciate it. I couldn't have done it without you. And I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks, everybody.